You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to the show. This is another episode of the Comedian's Comedian Podcast. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and today I'm speaking to Gianmarco Ceresi, who is, as you will hear at the start of this episode, certainly as far as my algorithm is concerned, absolutely everywhere. And that may be because I particularly like a particular sort of comedy. I don't know. Maybe, you know, we live in a siloed version of reality now whereby everyone's digital experience online is different to everyone else's. But nonetheless, you cannot deny the extent to which Gianmarco has managed to make the internet work for him. We're going to talk about how he's... Do you know what? I've headed the show notes with a quote from this, but it's actually in the extras now, that particular bit. He said, "I'm just a creative for an ad agency and the only product is me." And as I go on to say, I mean, that will... Some of you will be thinking, oh, Christ. But as I go on to say... It would be difficult. That might wind you up if he weren't so funny. And Gianmarco Ceresi is very, very funny indeed. He's driven. He works really, really hard. And we're going to talk about him growing up a theatre kid and his need to be witnessed. But we're also going to talk about his adoration of mathematically beautiful jokes. We'll refer a few times to Anthony Jeselnik and Rodney Dangerfield. And I think what Gianmarco is incredibly good at doing is kind of reducing down a larger comedy concept into a very small punchy bit. I don't think of him as a one-liner guy. He does have one-liners, but it's sort of like he's just very good at simmering down the wider kind of concept to just the punchy, pithy bits of it, but not necessarily, like in bits rather than one-liners. You will just have to watch his stuff online, as I did, and enjoy it a lot, and then, listen to this first, and then go and get stuck in. So, 20 minutes of extra content. We'll talk about the finer points of Gianmarco's online content strategy, and if you are a comic and you're interested in putting clips online, or even if you're thinking about it, or as we discuss, if you're an older comic who feels like, not even older, but just someone that hasn't started doing that yet because that wasn't the job that you signed up for, but it is now. I cannot recommend that bit enough. It's fascinating to hear someone talk about it in such depth and detail from the inside. We'll talk about that, and we'll also talk about that synthesis, that process by which longer routines become shorter jokes and vice versa. Loads of stuff, loads of technical bits and bobs here. This is peak ComCom. You're going to love it. Here's Gianmarco Ceresi. So welcome to the show, Gianmarco.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, it's great to have you. You're someone who is, your PR offered me your, they said, "Hey, Jay, check this guy out. You want to have him on the podcast?" And I went, "I know that name. Like, we've never worked together. We've never encountered each other." But the more I kind of pulled the thread, the more I kind of went, I know. And I just went, "Oh my God, you're everywhere."
That's the goal.
That's the goal.
It
that's
really
the goal.
Is. I mean, you know, I think the first like video I had that did really well was this R. Kelly pedophile joke, and the number of people that will be like, "Oh, you're the pedophile guy," and I'm like, "Sure, I'll take it. I'll take it. You'll get my name on the second video, you know?"
Yes, that perfectly encapsulates how social media giveth and taketh away.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you'll be famous, but maybe not in the way you intended. But you're just a machine, right? You've got like 500,000 subscribers on YouTube. You've got Instagram. I feel like you're someone who, I really, like, we'll talk about the art. Let's just get into the craft at the moment.
This is the art these days.
Yeah, well, this is the art these days, right? Uh-huh. But it's not. The pleasing thing about watching your stuff, and I've watched some of your crowd work compilations, loads of clips, your shelf life, your half-hour special, kind of end pandemic special. And what's really satisfying is to see someone crushing it on social media who also is a comedian. Do you know what I mean? It's the nexus of, oh, this is someone who is not simply spoofing crowd work so that you can get clips. You're doing really good crowd work and putting out the best bits. And, you know, you can write a joke and deliver a joke. And it seems like it's all going off right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think I got lucky. I started TikTok early enough in the pandemic when it was still like all these things become really hard to break into after a certain amount of time. But I was in there early on TikTok. I just started posting those TikToks as Instagram Reels, like right when Instagram Reels started. And I mean, I got so lucky. I got crazy lucky. And sometimes you're in those windfall moments on social media and you just got to lean in because it will not last forever. It will not last forever, and more people will start doing it. And I think it's taken a lot of my life away. But I just attacked all the apps, and I don't think I'm a master of any of the apps, but I've done okay on most of them, and it's been useful, obviously.
Yes. And did your YouTube channel predate those apps? Were you already putting stuff on YouTube?
Very poorly. I really tried breaking into YouTube before I was a stand-up comedian. I was doing sketch comedy. I booked some commercial work that was like very lucrative, and I spent almost all of it filming a high budget sketch series called Matza Pizza for my Jewish Italian heritage. And it really did not take off. I had a vision. I wanted to be one of these YouTube Britannic or there's all sorts of great sketch comedy channels, and that's what I wanted to be. But I was so new to social media. I didn't understand how to use it. I was late on YouTube, so I could not crack. I put these sketches up, $15,000 sketches, and it would get 400 views, 600 views. I hired PR. I did all the thumbnail. I tried everything, but it didn't work. It didn't work.
And what do you have a theory on why that was, or do you understand why it works now? Do you understand what's different in what you're doing?
Well, partly is like I'm able to post a new thing every day, and that's because of like the infrastructure of at least with TikTok in the beginning, I just had years of stand-up comedy jokes, and I write pretty tight setup punchlines. So I was just doing front-facing videos of all those jokes, and then videos of me doing those same jokes on stage. And part of what I'm able to do is just constantly, constantly, constantly post, and in a format that translates across platforms. So a tight joke, you know, it will work anywhere. That's the beauty of like really tight jokes.
Yes. Do you know, I thought that a few moments ago when I recognized a line that's on your biog, the one about actor friends. I shared the stage with some people who are now really huge real estate agents.
Yeah.
And I saw that on your website like an hour ago, and I thought, that's a lovely joke. That's a good joke to spend on a website. And then I saw it turn up in a special or a clip or something else. I was like, that's exactly right. You're very deftly repurposing short setup punch stuff.
I'm pretty shameless about it. And I think it's just a reality of how fractured everything is that all comedians have had to confront the kind of concept of like, you put it out and it's burnt. Like everyone's changed their philosophy on this, even in the last couple of years. And I just think, unlike the beginning, I thought if I made like a really great sketch, somehow it would go viral. And once in a while it did, but I didn't have a clear kind of through line. It was sketches that were exactly what I wanted to do. Some were 6 minutes, some were 30 seconds. And now I think I really have established, like, this is my sense of humor. I like dark comedy. I like tight jokes. And And I've gradually moved more to posting crowd work only because I have more followers. And so I'm more reticent about putting out material. Because I've just had a couple shows where, you know, someone in the front row kind of whispers a punchline to their friend before I say it. Or I had a heckler once. She was like a supportive heckler, but a heckler nonetheless, who was shouting out some punchlines. And I said, okay, fine. I've reached the point where I'm not going to put finished material out until I'm like, I'm really, truly done with it.
Yeah.
And, but at the beginning, it was those tight jokes that got me through. And maybe some people know them when they see me on stage. I don't really give a fuck at this point. I had to post them to get to the place of where I am today. Even reading that advertising book, like they would talk about certain tactics like that. And I don't go deep in the comments because I need to write my material. I have to keep space in my life for being alive and writing material and working that material. There's a different version of me where, like, if my sole goal was just to grow, if growth was number one, then yeah, I would do that shit. I've heard all the time you should engage in the comments. It helps. But it's too much. And I think, like, being a one-man band, it's like I have all the things within me. I am the creative exec going, what the fuck is this bullshit? Just we want to do this. And I'm also the CEO whose income is directly affected by the performance of the joke. I'm all these things in one. And you see comedians who go too far one way and they become pure brands and their jokes go away and they're succeeding, but it fucking sucks. And you see, or you don't see, the people who neglect all aspects of promo and dwindle away and can't even get stage time anymore to do the art that they so deeply wanted to do. I am constantly at war with myself to figure out these things. And some days I feel like I'm too much of a machine, and some days I feel like I'm not being crafty enough.
Oh, not being crafty enough, like not enough of a machine.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What are the things? What are the in the old, there's a parallel universe with the Gianmarco Cerezi in it who is leaning even further into the machine. What sorts of things is that guy doing that you're not doing?
Sure. I'll tell you, because you made a good point about, like, the things that go viral are identity things. Like, if a comedian comes to me and says, how do I break into TikTok? And they're Chinese. I go, if you have jokes about being Chinese, do that. Because that goes viral. Or if you have jokes about being Italian, or if you have jokes of being Canadian and moving to America, lean in. So for me, the jokes that really popped off in the beginning were my parents being divorced. And I have a lot about my parents' divorce. Because they got divorced when I was a baby. So I really grew up, that's all I knew. So I have just a lot of ideas about it. I have step-parents, former step-parents. And I milk it, but I could go even further. I could go even further. I have a lot about being Jewish, and I've gone far. I've gone far with both those things. One of my new merch shirts is going to say "Child of Divorce," but like, there's the next level of that's all I do, or all my crowd work is divorce, or all my crowd work is Jewish, or all my crowd work is Italian. It's more about, like, it could be even more about those things, or I could sit at home and just be like, more stepmom jokes, more single dad jokes, more. And I honestly think I don't necessarily have, like, the discipline or I get too bored to focus in that way, that I just kind of I really kind of follow whatever the funny thought is and just try to work it out. But that would be leaning more fully into it. And you see those people, and then you see people, like, I have a lot of friends who, let's say their brand is, they used to be a teacher and their whole thing is teachers, and teachers come and see their show and they do great. They sell better than me. They're touring. But then one day they go, okay, I'd like to talk about other things. And they have the struggle of, like, is their audience going to follow them? And so we all have our different struggles. Theirs just has a lot more money up front.
Yes, yeah, fair enough. I've spoken to people on this show where they made a name for themselves following a particular theme. And now they're like, Jesus, everyone keeps coming up and sharing their stories with me about social theme X, Y, Z. And I just want to go, look, I'm just a comic. And you sort of go, yeah, that was the deal with the devil that you may have accidentally made in, yeah, in hitching your, you know, I don't know what you hitch the things. What is it? A horse to a wagon, something like that.
But I also think it's like, part of it's just, yeah. But part of it's just like, how did you grow? Like, my dad's Italian, my mom's Jewish. I didn't grow up in a super Italian family or a super Jewish family. So there's only so much to be milked from it. Now, someone who grew up in an Italian family and they grew up in Jersey, they have so many ideas. They have so much to pull from it. They can talk about their Nona or whatever the fuck. And it's like Sebastian Maniscalco, like he sells out Madison Square Garden 5 times. And it's like, who knew there were that many Italians that close to Madison Square Garden to fill it up 5 times? But it's a mix of like, it's kind of my choice, but it's also because I only have so much to talk about there. I only have so many funny ideas. Now, if I was really just, oh, growth above all things, I would go hire some Jewish writers. Yeah, I would go hire some Italian writers. I would say like, okay, I've run out of Italian ideas, but my name is Gianmarco. Fucking let's churn it out. I never had a Nona, but tell me what's funny about a Nona. And ultimately, that's not what I find fun.
It's not what you find fun. And also, it would presumably involve a handing over of the reins of power. I mean, it's hard to, I know there are acts who'll do that. Presumably, there is also a part of you, sure, which is like, well, why would I? Like, I mean, I, you know, like the idea of someone writes you some jokes and you say those jokes. Have you ever done that in a capacity? Have you ever done that for like corporate work or something whereby you've been speaking other people's words or panel games or something?
Well, once in a while, I love tight jokes. So like I did a corporate gig recently for Mars, which they do like M&Ms and Snickers. And I asked two comedians to add some jokes for me, like a writer's room.
Sure.
I do love it. With tight jokes, tight like Weekend Update, late night style jokes, I'll say anything if I think it's a good joke. I think that's fun to do. But for my act,
yeah,
it's so personal. A couple times in my life, a comedian named JP McDade, we did a roast battle, and he's so good at roasting. And he said like, but he is so good at roasting. He said like two things about my essence that were so true that I said to him, like, can I try to incorporate this into my act? He was like, of course. What am I going to do with this?
Can you tell me what one of them is? Can we discuss the...
Yeah.
Like, because I think the seeing someone else's, another brilliant comic's attitude, like their interpretation of what your essence is. Oh, I can see that's like, oh, sure, that's like royal jelly.
Sure. I think it would hit more of it if I was on stage. And I'm still working to figure out the exact way to say it,
okay,
from my perspective. But he said to me that it looks like before you tell a joke, you whisper to yourself a 5, 6, 7, 8. And I learned two big lessons that roast battle. So it was a great joke. It crushed. It crushed. It's one of those roast jokes that is so amazing because it feels like 100%. It reveals the truth. It's not even like a setup punchline. And then a comedian named Aaron Berg, who was judging it, I lost the battle, but it was like a good battle. I really worked hard, but JP won. And Aaron said, you would have won if right before you said your joke, you had gone a 5, 6, 7, 8. And I was like, fuck.
But you were too busy reeling from, so, oh my God, he's got me. Oh, fuck, he's
too,
got
too
me.
Busy.
Yeah.
How do I get him? How do I get him? And like, when he said that to me, I would do anything. If I could go back in time, instead of killing Hitler, I would go back just to that roast battle so I could do that. Because it would have felt so good.
That's,
I can
magnificent.
See it in my mind.
With regard to that, just as an insight into like, what do you read into that of his interpretation of your essence? Like, because clearly, obviously that went off because he hit the right note. It resonated because he was like, yeah, he does have that essence. But what is that? Is it kind of like a sort of smug musicality? Like what quality is that?
No. I think it's more of, it's that kid who like, I want to be there. I can't pretend that I don't want to be there. And I want it, and like, even if I'm trying to be cool, you can see that like, this is where I need to be. and it's a neediness and a like, I'm gonna give it my all. Yes. I'm gonna be sweating. And that's who I am.
You were, I was a theater kid. I mean, you do radiate. I don't know that you radiate theater kid, but when you find out you were a theater kid, it's like, yeah, checks out.
Yeah, there's I want to go on stage, and you can see that I just want to open my arms up like this and make myself big and just stretch out my hands and dance and move. And that's who I am. And I think, like, as much as I love, like, someone like an Anthony Jeselnik, and I like how cool he is, there's part of me that's like, no matter how dark I want to be and how fucked up and tight I want my jokes to be, to deny that I also want to move and, like, express myself would be a fool's errand. Totally. I have to embrace it. And for some people, they'll be like, ugh, that's a lot. And it's like, fine, they're not my fans. That's fine.
It's so hard, isn't it? The moment when you realize you're not cool.
Yeah, it is. And there's always a part of you that wants to be. I mean, you see comedians where they start getting money and they get the nicer clothes. And part of it is like, okay, but remember, cool and funny aren't the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. It's just that it's like that, you know, rock and roll guys who are just like, I want to be, you know, I want to kind of be on fire in a leather jacket, like rocking out. And then it turns out what they're really good at is a madrigal, or, do you know what I mean? Or like the piano or the harp or something. They're like, this is the muse I have. Shit. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I think in comedy, you see a lot, you see people rejecting who they are rather than embracing it, because it's painful to embrace it. Because you have, like, that's the thing about clowning, isn't it? You have to own your flaws. And if you might think your flaws are, oh, I'm so kind of anxiety ridden and special, but no, those aren't your flaws. You're smug and you're boring, or whatever the thing is, you know what I mean? And you have to go, oh, I have to own them? No! So this is Gianmarco. I'm really enjoying chatting to him. And later on, he will go on to talk about Jeffrey Asmus, who I had not heard about before and who immediately Googled and have been recommending to everybody. Jeffrey Asmus is going to come on the show as well. So thanks, Gianmarco, for setting that up. That will be coming up in a few episodes. Also in the can, I'm waiting for clearance with a particular episode, which I'm really hopeful can come to you. I've also got a few others in the can. We have the fabulous Jeff Shaw. As I said, Jeffrey is coming up as well. I'm speaking to a couple of other very exciting people, including one. I mean, if you're in the Insiders group, if you're in the Facebook group, I think I've sort of mentioned it in there. I'm not going to say it here in case it doesn't happen. I always feel like it hexes it. But someone who I've been trying to get on the show for probably 8 years or more has agreed to come on. I can't wait for that. I'm so excited. If you're in the Facebook group or the Insiders Club, you will know already who that is, and you can submit questions for the person in the Facebook group. So you can find 20 minutes of extras from this at comedianscomedian.com/insiders, as well as the exclusive Insiders Q&As. Oh, I tell you who else we've got coming up is Nish Kumar. That's not just Insiders. That's a sort of public to everybody show that will probably be coming out in the beginning of August. Nish returned to the show 8 years on. From a time when we used to live together. And I mean, I think we were both in very, very different positions in our lives. But that is a cracking episode. And I'm still working on the Boutros, my wee boy, my 7-year-old now. Yes, 7, you're old. To allow me to include at the end of the episode a very, very funny interaction between the two of them. Currently, he heard it and he's like, you can't put that out. I think I could work on him for your benefit. So that's coming up as well. I'm going to tell you, did I tell you this before? This is my excitable Edinburgh list. It's growing weekly. These are the people I'm going to be excited to see at the Edinburgh Festival. Elf Lyons doing a BSL show with someone else whose name I forget. Apologies, I just knew. Oh, I'll just Google Elf and then I'll find that. Ted Hill tries and fails to fix climate change. Ben Tarje of this podcast is doing he's doing a show about the caring industry, the care industry and being a carer. Lachlan Werner, I'm looking forward to. Matt Ewins, I saw a preview of some of his stuff. His show is called Mr. TikTok. Can't wait for that. Patty Harrison, I can't wait to see. Bill O'Neill comes very highly regarded. I've yet to see Ollie Horn do a full Edinburgh hour, so I'm going to do that. Nabil Abdul Rashid, and he did a preview with me, and people were just blown away by the time I went on. So thanks, Nabil. If you want someone to make your job harder, apparently Nabil's new show, which is called The Purple Pill, I think, I've not heard a word from it, but everyone was just losing their minds. So loads of stuff there. It is there is a huge thread. I think there's about 50 or 60 people on it now who are members of the Comedians Comedian listenership community. Or it's, I mean, you can't do the acronyms. That's what Richard does all the time, isn't it? The ComCom ListCom. Oh, Christ. Anyway, the people in the Facebook group, there's like 60 plus people who are listeners to this show and who are taking shows to the Edinburgh Festival. So in a future episode, maybe next week, if I remember, I will read out all of them. That would be nice. That's all of that. My show, of course, is on sale now and selling nicely. That's very exciting. So jump in there. It is, of course, at Monkey Barrel. So you can just take a risk on the day and turn up and pay what you want. But it's looking like it's selling quite well. So please go to stuartgoldsmith.com and follow the relevant, very simple links in order to hop onto the Goldsmith pipeline and buy tickets for my Edinburgh show, Spoilers, which won Best New Show. No, Best Show. Even less qualified than that, Best Show. At the Leicester Comedy Festival. It's a great joy, and I think you'll enjoy it. So, thanks to everyone that came along and saw it at 2 Northbound. What a banger preview that was. Lovely. Right, enough of this. Let's get back to the subject of this episode, Mr. Gianmarco Cerezi.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
There was a long time where, because I truly grew up with a lot of theatrical training. I did the clown in class. I did the like putting on a mask and moving around. And in the beginning of stand-up, it was sometimes really at odds, like because the jokes weren't there and I would get by on my performance and my theatricality. And it really was doing roast battles. Whenever someone asked me like, how do I like become a better comedian, I love roast battles because the objective is so clear, what you're trying to do in a roast battle. And a lot of the tricks that can work on stage do not work in roast battles. And so I would do these and I would bomb so hard. My theater kid energy is not winning me any roast battles, that's for sure. And only in the last, I really do feel like in the last year or 2 years, as I felt more confident as a writer, do I now feel like, oh, now I can let that theater kid out within the joke I've constructed, and it makes it a special thing. There was a time I would be anxious if someone accused me of being like just loud or just theatrical. And now I don't feel that fear because I'm not confident about everything, but I'm like, no, I have some jokes that are well constructed. And if I say them loud or if I'm like dancing while I'm doing it or whatever the fuck, that does not take away from the fact that mathematically, this is a beautiful joke.
That's lovely. I'm just wondering, just to drill down on that theatre kidness, it's not, my guess is that it's not simply being loud or being sort of physically big and sort of physically animated, but there is also, as JP McDade suggested, there is something about, or as you suggested as well, it's not just the energy on stage, it's kind of the internal energy. It's the sort of love me energy of a theatre.
Yeah.
Right? So to let that out for someone whose jokes are, some of your jokes are very kind of snappy or catty, or you're kind of let's get the knife in a really deft way, yeah, like that. To combine that with so that I am loved is like that. Yes. That feels like a really rich sort of a texture, right?
Yeah. I think like you can, you know, some people, they'll just say the naughty thing and everyone laughs. But you can see me say the naughty thing and then be like, I hope, please still like me. And I think that's an interesting conflict to see that, those inner workings. I think more about just how acting, how I can use those tools. I think with some acting stuff, I can really lean into a misdirection. Because yeah. I know how to make the audience think that I'm having an emotional moment, perhaps, or I'm really struggling to come up with the words. And you can just, a regular misdirection, you can really get them, especially a mean one.
Can you give me an example?
I'll give you one that I love to tell. So I go, my grandpa turned 98 last October. And I called him to wish him a happy birthday, and he ended up talking to me for hours. He talked to me for hours about, you know, being born in the later part of the Great Depression, and he served in World War II. He protested the Vietnam War, and at the end he said, "If I have any wisdom to share from all my years on this earth, it's this: don't waste your youth." So I took his advice and never called him again. And I just love it because, especially depending on where I tell it in the show, I really gain that audience's trust again. And, totally. You know, they're foolish for following me along, but foolish in a good way. And if I really take my time with some setups and I really breathe into it, enough of them are like, oh, wow, I guess he's going to like share a sweet thought right now.
Sure.
And I love doing that. I love that. It's my favorite thing to do.
I love doing that as well. That is so fun, isn't it? To you can feel yourself, because like an actor, or I know that you are an actor. I've been an actor. It's not something I pursue anymore. But the knowledge that you're on it, like we know what it's like to be on it, like in flow as a comic when you're improvising, say, but when the elements of the physical performance kind of inhabit and enliven the bit, that's not something that comes up a lot on this podcast. People are quite kind of, here's my attitude, here are my jokes, but actually just the sort of like breathing in, like sometimes we're like, fuck, I'm performing this really well.
Yeah.
And I'm performing it differently. And this is 10 times better than I normally do this bit.
Yeah. And I think people are allergic to it just because how many bad joke writers just go out there and blah, 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 and make noises and tickle the audience or whatever. And especially, I mean, when I was coming up, there was a comedy club in New York, where the booker at the time said that I was too one-man show. And, okay. And it was, you know, part of me had that thought of like, should I change? Should I be more chill? Part of me was upset because I was like, well, you told me to kill for 5 minutes. If you, I can be mumbly. I can stand there. I've done shows tired. I don't have to do this. It just was fun. It's what I am. And I think that was just the attitude. I think that was just the attitude, or comedians have that attitude at different times in their lives. And then Sebastian Maniscalco sells out Madison Square Garden 5 times and they go, oh, maybe I'm going to move a little. Maybe I'm going to move for a second. but again, it's just who I am. And it's just like accepting that I am that theater kid and I'm going to be loud. I'm going to be loud.
When did you first in stand up? When did you first feel like yourself on stage?
I really think the only reason I found it wasn't a specific moment, but it was, I worked at this horrible, horrible club in New York called LOL. And it's one of these clubs, if you're working there, you shouldn't even talk. People will be like, don't say that. People will judge you for this. This is the club that they bark in people from Times Square, tourists, drunk. But I basically did every check spot there, which you guys, I don't know if you do, you don't
we
do
don't
check
have
spots.
A check. I know what it is.
Everyone knows what check spot is, where they drop the check. And
we also don't have the expression drop the check, but what it means is that so people listening in the UK, where we sensibly have an interval through which people can get drinks, in America, they for no reason choose to, well, no, I'm sure for reasons, but they make this insane choice that they will have waiting staff walking around during the headliner. So everyone can pay their taps.
Yes. And right? during,
so there's lots of chat and conversation during what could otherwise be an excellent bit of the show.
And it brings the whole room down. It's awkward. And in on showcase shows where it's a bunch of comedians, they will literally delegate a spot as the check spot. And gotcha. So the show would be like host, comic, check spot. And then they're the ones who're supposed to eat shit. I mean, it is the shit spot. And then the final comic to close it out. And part of the reasoning is, I guess, they want to turn over the room quicker. Part of it is they worry, especially at this kind of club, people are just going to leave without paying. Which, at this particular club, fair point. It's a fair point.
Okay.
And even worse, they give it to a new comic, but it's usually unpaid. At this club, a lot of things are unpaid. So I kind of did every check spot for basically a year. And this is like, it's very rare. There's so many comedians in New York that I was doing four shows a night at this club. And it is very hard to do that as a newer comedian in the city. But I think it was only doing this club where on Fridays and Saturdays, the last show started at 1 a.m. that it wasn't until I was going up at 2:15 a.m. and I was so fucking tired and I was not getting paid and I was not happy and there was no green room and I'm sitting in the bar listening to the same goddamn playlist for the third time that night that I started going on stage with I don't give a fuck or I'm too tired to pretend attitude. And I really think it's only those moments that force you to you can't add anything. You can't pretend you're something you're not. It is the shows, it is the headlining shows where the airplane was delayed and I didn't get my bag and I get to the club 5 minutes before I go on stage where I'm not happy about it. I didn't get to write down my notes. I'm not feeling good. I need to take a shit. Those are the shows where you see what you're really capable of truthfully on stage and you end up learning a lot from it, as awful as it is in the moment, that you just don't have the energy to put anything on.
I totally understand that. Is it only those shows? I do wonder whether so much like this, that concept comes up time and time again. It's like, if you eat shit to such an extent that you go, I just don't care anymore, and then bang, you access.
Well, you don't have to eat shit. You can do well. It's more just like you go on stage without being scared. I think
without ceremony somehow.
Yeah, and I think there's just, you know, when I did JFL last year, I did New Faces.
I saw the set. Fantastic.
Thank you. And I really do think part of what made it go well is we were backstage. I was on the second show and I was backstage in that green room for like 3.5 hours. And I felt all that anxiety, all that stress. This is such a big show. Everyone talks about this shit. Everyone said that when Shane Gillis did it, it was the blah, blah, blah. And I was there for so long that I got tired. The anxiety expired. I broke through like a cold sweat. And I was just, it got to the point where I was like, fuck, let's get this over with. Jesus Christ. And because of that, and the second show, it was so funny. Pete Holmes, it was hosting it. He told us in the second show, he's like, just so you guys know, second show's usually better. You know, the audience are a little drunker. It's a little later. And then he went up to host the second show. He came back and he went, they are tired. I've never seen this before. And part of it is just like that was going bad. It was a tough crowd. I was tired, anxious, had expired that I wanted to go up there and have a good time for me. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's it. I'm trying to find it as I talk about it. But like part of it is like I went up there to have fun. I hate to say it because it's so trite, but it's not just have fun. I went up there to do what I wanted to do. And that's be big, and that's take my time, and that's move around the stage. And I think a lot of things just went right that night in terms of like the chemicals that need the processes that need to occur for me to be at my best.
Can you contrive that? Can you hack your way into that feeling in other circumstances? If you turn up and think, you know, you're just in a shit mood, have you got anything? Have you got a mantra or a manifesto or a routine, some kind of magic trick to get you in the right place?
I try to remind myself that, like, and I learned this from, there's a comedian named Ken Boyd in New York who I worked with at LOL, who's really good. And he was always having a blast on stage. And I really try to remind myself, I'm like, the best sets I ever had, I was enjoying myself. And so sometimes, you know, if there's music before, I will try to be like, just dance to it, fucking feel it from before I go on stage. When I was a kid, I used to box. I need to be physical. So I will try to do those things, as embarrassing as it is, to like engage that part of me of being like, I get to fucking move on stage and be witnessed. That's all I've ever wanted since I was a kid, was to be fucking witnessed while I was yelling and moving. And I try to tap into that. And then I think there's just the reality that the more you do it, the more it becomes second nature. Someone once told me about Liza Minnelli, my musical theater days. And Liza had been performing since she was a kid. And they just talked about her being on stage, that when the curtain went up and the curtain went down, she did not change that much. That was part of regular life for her. And when I'm really, that's why if you see me on that second show of the night, or if there's three, I've only had to have a couple of three headlining shows. You see me for that third one, I'm in a good place. I'm tired. I'm beaten, but I've been on the stage. It's like my living room now. I'm just living. And, yeah, I think that just comes with time. And that's why I think even when a really good comedian, if they took a long break from stand-up and they try to come back, something's missing. And it's that. You got to be living up there.
Why do you need to be witnessed?
You know, I'm not sure. I'm sure I could look back and go, parents divorce. I think both my parents, and I say this as a narcissist myself, I think they both have narcissistic tendencies. And I wonder if there was a degree where I didn't feel as wanted or loved. They were fine parents, but I wonder if it's because of that lent it to me. But I also think it's just part of my DNA. When I was very young, 4 or 5, I would dance in the living room at both my parents' respective houses, my mom's house and my dad's house. They'd put on disco and I would dance. And I insisted, I was like, we need to get our living room on a stage. And in my head, I was thinking like, not a comedy club, a stadium. I was like, we need to recreate this living room on stage because other people need to witness this. And it wasn't fully like they need to see how good I am. It was, I'm feeling joy. I'm feeling so much fun that it's that people should see. People need to, I don't know, man. I don't know if it's tied to our deep internal need for a God. I wonder if I was more religious, I could just, you know, dance alone and be like, well, God's witnessing it. That's good enough. But but I really, it's really just a part of like who I am. If I feel joy, I want others to see it. And only in being witness as I'm experiencing it, does it close the loop for me.
Whoa. That's great. That's great.
Yeah, it's great. Witness. It's great. It's a, but it's a fucking nightmare to be around. You know, I'm always like, fuck, sure. No one saw this. I want to be known. Like, I think that's why I'm more of an autobiographical performer. Even with my, you know, dark, twisty one-liners. Like, yeah, I didn't not call my grandpa again. But that joke is informed by the, like, deep feeling of, like, I go on the phone with my grandpa and I don't want to talk to him at all. And he's this man sure. with this. It's related to my core narcissism yes. and confronting it.
And it's relatable, but you've zeroed yes. in on something specific and it's become relatable because we all don't want to talk to our grandparents, yeah. you know, whilst loving them.
Yeah. And I you know, again, we're just trying to like articulate feelings, which is a fool's errand in some way. But like, I think part of the reason that I talk about myself is that in being witnessed, it's not just look at me juggle. Part of me wants, I want them to know my internal feelings. And that's just, I have to do it. I have to do it. That's what I have to talk about on stage. To talk about something completely made up almost feels like, well, who gives a fuck? I think there's some people that just want to be witnessed, period, and they become reality TV stars. I want to be witnessed, and I want it to be for a good reason. I want it to be because it's worthy of being witnessed. You know, if I just want to be witnessed, I could go masturbate in Times Square. I'll be witnessed by a lot of people. But, like, I also want it to be worth it for the people watching it. I don't want to force them. I don't want to just be an asshole, you know?
And you want to do that by articulating a feeling or a thought. I mean, a feeling, I think.
Yeah.
More than, yeah, thoughts, you know, you use thoughts to express them. But it's, I think for you, it's a feeling thing. And you want to go, I feel, there's a brilliant Australian comic called Laura Davis who said, and I don't know if this is her original thought, I attribute it to her all the time, but she said the job of any artist is to take out kind of a shard of your heart and hold it up to the light and say, look at that, you too?
Yeah.
You too? Like that. And so I think that's, I really connect with that a lot. I think that's a really beautiful and precious idea. This thing, I felt this, is that, can I put this in a way
yeah.
that you will all go, yes, yes. And you have that kind of communion.
Yeah. And I think what I like about what I think the reason that I really lean on the very tight jokes and like jokes where it's, you know, they succeed or fail is I get to share that thought, but I get to articulate it in such a kind of carefully crafted thing that even if you don't like me or even if you think the thought is a stupid thought, the delivery mechanism works. It functions. So like you know, whether you want to know me or not, you're going to take that joke. And that's what I want, again, this could be, you know, this is self-aggrandizing, but this is what I'm trying to achieve. Is like, I love one-liners. I love the Rodney Dangerfields. I love the Anthony Jeselniks. I want to use that format of these tight things that pop in your brain when the punchline hits and infuse them and fill them and have them come from my truthful, real emotional feelings. And I think that's fun. I think that's a fun challenge to dedicate my life's work to.
I'm thinking of, just in terms of the short jokes, I'm thinking of that one you have about your sports teacher, a sports instructor saying you miss 100% of the shots that you take.
Yeah.
What a beautiful gag.
Thank you.
So are you writing those? Are you putting yourself in a state where they tumble out of you and you record it and you go, oh, I can sharpen it now? Are you working on a blank page?
I mean, honestly, sometimes you look back on like, especially like that joke I told about my grandpa, and I'm like, how did I even how did I even get there? I don't even know what the evolution was. I will get stoned and I will write out a lot of thoughts. And some of them, they
how
start up more.
How do you have time to get stoned? What with the machine?
I do a lot of micro dosing these days. But when I did roast battles, I mean, because you know, in roast, sometimes you just got to break outside the box to really think of something funny. And when I would get stoned, it just let me see things in a different way. And I would write a lot of terrible jokes, but it made me think. It made my funny things being funny a little heightened. And so every little thing that tingled a little, I was like, ooh, let's write that down. Ooh, let's write that down. Mm-hmm. And then I get sober and I go through and I delete 90% of it and find those funny thoughts. And then I'm like, okay, how do I articulate it in a way? That's when I get mathematical about it. How do I articulate it in a way where they're getting just as much information as they need and I'm holding back just enough information that the punchline is as surprising as possible?
Yes. So it's the inspiration phase and then the editing phase. And so you've got the kind of the rough material and then it's the kind of tinkering technical phase.
Yeah. I'm known to a degree of always having my laptop out in a way that's obnoxious for many, but like that's me doing the editing phase, living life. And when I get stoned or I'm with my girlfriend and we're stoned or not, that's the inspiration phase. And that's why I write a bunch of things down in my notes app on my phone. And then everything else is editing. And I have so many thoughts that I still think are great that I haven't figured out a way to say it yet. And it sits in a document and I chisel away at it every single goddamn day.
Can you share a note or a chiseler with us?
Let's see. So yeah, sure. One joke I've been tinkering with, I talk about how I started doing drugs, this year kind of for the first time again. So this isn't going to be fully polished, but I totally understand.
The beats of it
are like, you know, I have a lot of friends my age now they're getting sober and I'm like, really? Right before all the funerals start? And like, so that's the first part. And then like, you know, I want to do drugs because to deal with my mortality. I don't want my last words to be like, I should have worked less. I wanted to be like, I am so fucked up right now, dude. like, you know, and you don't want to wait. You don't want to try an edible for the first time on your deathbed. And then your last words are like, I don't think it's kicked in yet. And then like the last line that I'm trying to articulate is like, you know, I want to be so high, even if there's no God, I still get to meet that motherfucker. And it's figuring out a way. I've been tinkering all these different ways. Even if there's no God, I want to be so high, I still get to meet that motherfucker. You know, I don't believe in God, but that doesn't mean I don't want to meet that mother. You know, it's and then not motherfucker sure. To meet that God. It's like, I know with that line. And again, this chunk is one that I'm still developing, but it feels true. I know that the reason I didn't want to do shrooms for a long time was because I was like, if I don't have a religious experience, then I don't have anything to look forward to someday. Now I know there's just nothing. You know, that's why I'm scared to do ayahuasca. What if I don't see God? Then I know that I'm never seeing God. Sure. And so I know that thought is true. I know there's something there. But it's figuring out a way to articulate where I'm not giving away what I'm about to say, and how do I deliver that information where I'm really surprising you, with the twist being, even if there's not a God, I want to meet God. And how do I deliver that? Something I know that thought, there is a version of that joke that catches the audience off guard and will get a big laugh. Because all of that works, but it's not up to what I know it can be.
And the next phase of it, is it a performance phase and I'm working out the blocks on stage, or is it in a writing phase?
I think it vacillates. Like sometimes I'll be telling that joke on stage and I'm like, I haven't changed anything. It's going to do fine like it did last time. What the fuck are you doing? You need to sit down. Sometimes I need to go get high and reapproach it. Sometimes you have to really fight yourself and be like, abandon the joke that you have written and re-explore this thing. Talk it out loud.
Yes, that can be such a limitation, can't it? You've got a funny idea, you write it down once and you're like, well, I guess that's the joke now. No, it isn't. That's not, like, that's the latest expression of it. And if you've said it three times, then you're like, oh, fuck, I can't think, I can't approach it as fresh as I was the first time.
And sometimes there's a degree of, you keep wanting to say the fact. You keep wanting to say the truth. Your job as a comedian is to make it funny. So another example, I was trying to come up with an idea of like, I'm Jewish. And so there's this degree of the Jews run Hollywood. That's what people say. And part of me was trying to come up with a joke of like, well, back in the vaudeville days in New York, Jews were only allowed to work in show business. So I was like, what's the joke of like, well, you made us do this and now you're mad that we do this. And I kept working. And the problem is it was too factual. I was almost like trying to make an argument, not a joke. And so yeah. Now I don't know how, but one day I said, people say to me, the Jews run Hollywood. Well, then how about a fucking thank you? I mean, have you ever seen a Christian movie? They fucking suck. Oh, let me guess, the main character is Jesus Christ. Oh, no, he died. I wonder if he'll come back to life, you fucking hack. And it's like, I was trying to make funny the argument as opposed to going, you know what? Yes, we do run it. And it's like in there, you surprise someone. Everyone says the Jews don't actually run Hollywood. That's not funny. That's not funny. Yeah, that's what you're going to see in an argument. My job is to be funny. And hopefully you see that I'm not like literally saying it. You're seeing the joke of it. But sometimes that's the challenge where I keep going. And some comedians, they will roll with that. They'll roll with the argument. That's not who I am. I want to fucking surprise you. I want to make you laugh really hard before you can even think, why am I laughing? And that's what I think is a one-liner's job. And it becomes even harder the more, if you know I'm going to be a dark comedian or I'm going to do a twist like that, you're looking for it. So you really got to surprise.
See that all the time.
Rodney Dangerfield, we all knew all the jokes were going to be about how much he's a loser. So he had to write such good jokes because you had to be like, oh my God, I can't believe that's where it was. Same with Anthony Jeselnik. Like, sure. I think it must be so hard to be Anthony Jeselnik because to write in that character, because he has committed himself to always being, I can bounce around. Maybe my dad's the asshole. Maybe I'm the asshole. Maybe I'm nice here, but then mean here. Jeselnik's character is like, every punchline is going to be monstrous. And that's probably why he needs 4 years before he writes, you know, his next hour, because it's hard.
With it's interesting you say that about the line of an argument, like you're trying to win an argument or you're trying to kind of put forward an argument for something and you go, nope, be silly. Like my new show, the show I'm writing at the moment, I'm taking to Edinburgh Festival this year, is about the climate crisis. Mm. And it's like an earnest heart on my sleeve. I'm really terrified about the climate crisis. Uh-huh. Let's talk about it. It's not couched in metaphor. It is what it is. And I think that's a multiplicity of challenges there involved in, hey, I want people who are scared to feel better. Some people aren't scared. Shit, have I got to make them scared? Like, if they haven't done the reading, have I got to terrify my audience by pointing out how bad things are? But last night, for the first time, I did a show where I introduced that bit of material just by saying, just on a whim, I said, so I'm feeling pretty great about the climate crisis. And it just got this wallop of a laugh. And I went, oh, yes, because I'm being silly.
Yeah.
So they know I don't mean that. And so we're back to comedy rather than, right, strap in, I'm going to upset you.
it's always to be sincere. I had a heckle. I was in North Carolina and Brittany Griner. Do you know who Brittany Griner is?
I do know who Brittany Griner is, yes.
So in case anyone was
imprisoned in Russia.
She was imprisoned in Russia. She had like a minuscule amount of some kind of vape oil with THC in it. And she had just been released. And I had a joke that I really liked. I stopped telling it because it expired quickly, but it was like, you know, Brittany Griner was released. And I think that's fantastic. But we should, even though that's great, we should remember that there are tens of thousands of men and women in American prisons who could destroy her at basketball. And again, like, I was getting ready for that joke, which is like a twist on the thing. It's not sincere. Yeah. And I said, Brittany Griner was released from Russian prison. And someone in the back went, boo. And before the comedian could take over, that liberal leftist in me said, it was so embarrassing. I said, I actually think it's a good thing when American prisoners are released from foreign prisons. I guess that's like I said, the total lecture, you're mean and that's a bad thought. And it makes me not want to live in this country anymore. And it wasn't funny. It wasn't funny. And I couldn't get back in the joke. And I look back on it like you lost the battle. I mean, it's I'm not up there to listen. If I want to go convince this guy that it's good that an American was freed from a Russian prison, I'm not going to do that from the comedy club stage. I'm going to need to change the education system in America. Part of looking like a loser is thinking that I could win that battle. Oh, I'm going to lecture him into what? Caring for the WNBA players? I can't do that. That is a false battle. So I'm a loser. I'm just trying to like nag him. All I can do right now is be funny, and hopefully he'll like me, and maybe in some grand scheme thing, he'll gradually become a leftist liberal because he loves leftist liberal comedians. I'm not going to win the battle going, hey, buddy, that's not cool.
Yeah.
And I try to remember it all the time in crowd work that it's just like the moment you're angry or the moment you're trying to make a point and not make them laugh, you will lose.
Do you, like, you clearly have a great facility for mining subjects for premises. You've got really good premises. And I think that's a thing. I think of that as like a classic New York thing. You've got so little time. Do you know what I mean? You're so little time on stage, so much competition. There's no room for bagginess. You have to press all the air out of it. So I find with some comics, yourself included, where almost like every joke is its own premise. Like, do you know what I mean? It's either a premise or it's a tag on the joke, but there's nothing else.
Yeah. I think I just like that kind of comedy. There's an amazing comedian named Jeffrey Asmus who like, he's like that even more. Just every joke can exist on its own. And his tags are incredible. Tags are so tough. Because
just let me interrupt you. Asmus, Jeffrey Asmus.
Yes. It's Jeffrey with a G, G-E-O.
Okay.
Oh, incredible. Hard to watch because you're just like, fuck. I mean, when he's on a roll, every joke gets an applause break because he so beautifully sets it up, hits it. And then his tags, the tag, it cannot be a smaller laugh than the first punchline. Yeah.
And 100%. It drives me insane when I see people do tags that get less than the punchline.
Of course. And the tags have to like somehow reinvent it. The tags have to be a twist off the twist. And he'll do twist after twist after twist. And I just like that kind of comedy. And especially once you do comedy for so long, charisma doesn't mean as much to me anymore. I really do sit there and I just want to hear like great jokes and where I go, wow, that was an incredible twist.
That's interesting. Yes, I think I want to see the person. I love seeing the person. Sure. I love seeing the person confront something, like the authentic person, the flash of the really authentic person.
Sure, and I agree, but too. I think you can see that authentic person with super tight jokes. And I just think we see, and this is part of the economy of this having to generate so much material, where I think the person outshines the comedies to a deep degree. And then suddenly I'm watching a special where I'm like, what is this? What is this? You're just being charismatic. And I have charismatic friends. I'd rather spend time with them. So few comedians stay great because it takes a lifetime and it takes your full investment. You cannot shortcut it. You cannot get someone else to write it for you, because it loses something. And I think every comedian, and if I'm successful, it will be the struggle of, will I make time for this craft or will I not? I sometimes admire those great comedians who stopped doing stand-up, because part of me goes like, you know what? They knew that if they just did it on the side, it would not be worth the audience's mm-hmm. time.
And then you have kids and you go, oh, I don't have anything like as much time anymore.
Mm-hmm. Or you start entertaining your kid and
you realize it's better.
Your sense of humor becomes that's what I think dad jokes are. Like there's a trope of like dad jokes, but I think it's like parent jokes. I think it's just like you're trying to entertain your kid. And you're trying to entertain them fast. You don't have time for a long setup. So you start going, what do you call a fish without eyes? And it's like that makes your 2-year-old laugh, you know, 4-year-old laugh. And you're like, okay, that's the bar.
Yeah.
That's the bar.
Where does it end for you? What's the goal? Is there a goal? Is the goal just to keep busy and keep working and keep traveling, hopefully? Or is there have you got an end point ambition? You're like, that's when I'd give up.
I think like I've come to embrace a little bit of like the joy is in the journey. Because the most joy I feel is when that new joke works. That's better than when I do the perfect version for the hot crowd or when it's that moment of it worked. And I think I have to discipline myself for economic reasons. I want to film a special. I want to get to a place where I'm a little bit more like where I have the infrastructure and the people who want it and the money to go like, okay, I need to film a special and I'm trying to this year. That's my goal. I desperately need to like that heart surgery thing. It is really strong. I need a deadline in sight, tighten it up a little more and be done with it. Mm-hmm. I want to do that because I know how good it feels to have something in the can and done and go, wow, I made something and you can go see it there. It's a good feeling. So in my mind, my real goal is to like have a little bit more of that, a little more completion in my life, a little more when I finish this thing, I have the infrastructure to put it on film and put it to bed and feel like, wow, I did that thing. Mixed with, I want to continue touring, hopefully with a little more money and comfort and less shows with 14 people and find a way to live a healthy life where I still get to really be creative and really work out new stuff on the page, work out new stuff on stage, get more comfortable having an idea and pursuing it on stage and writing on stage, as they say. I love that. That's what makes me feel so good. So I want a life where I'm able to do that and do that well and film a special and maybe act, maybe write a script. But in my heart, I'd love to be on stage. I am a theater kid and my happiness is when I'm on stage. And so I want a life built around being able to do that and to do that well.
I wondered how long you said that. I'm familiar with that sentiment. I feel that myself. The best moment in my day is when I have an idea for a joke and I try it and it works. And I think, yes, it's real. This is real. I can do this thing. How long did the feeling last when you hit, I don't know, some arbitrary milestone, 500,000 YouTube subscribers, and you saw the numbers tick up and you went, there we go. Look at that, 500,000. And you probably, I would guess, felt a certain kind of, I put a lot of work into that, and that is a real metric that is a little less ephemeral than telling a joke and it dissipates. How long did that feeling last?
It fades so fast. It becomes so quickly. I think what makes it weird is like other people, they go to you and they go like, you must feel great. And if you don't feel great, you're like, oh no, I don't feel great. What's wrong with me?
Sure.
It's cool. It's fun. But at the end of the day, it's just a number in the corner of a box. I think what I like about comedy is like, I have real respect for some comedians. I really, their mind, I find so admirable. And when Jeffrey Asmus, who it's embarrassing, honestly, how much I fawn over him, because we really are peers.
Yeah.
But like when someone like him says to me, oh, that one joke, fuck. To me, that feels really good. And I think it's hard as you get older, everyone is complimenting you for different purposes. And it's hard to trust. You become skeptical of everyone's desires. You see people promote specials that you know they don't like, but it's for the person. I mean, everyone just becomes liars, constant liars. And it's, to me, it's like, it's important, the people in my life, whether it's some comedian who I really respect, or it's my girlfriend who is a genius comedically. She's a manager, but just very smart. Or it's like one of my good friends who I respect. It's like when they tell me something is funny, that means a lot. And ultimately, a retweet or whatever, it doesn't feel as good as seeing a person throw their head back and laugh, because you know, for the most part, they're not faking it. And so, you know, it's a nice feeling. It's definitely better than when a video bombs, but it's hollow. And it's not the same as getting it from one person that you really admire.
A beautiful place to end it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So that was Gianmarco. I mean, come on, right? Come on. So good and so funny and eloquent and just, you know, you can't fucking argue with that work ethic, right? Get the stuff out. The CEO of the brand, all of that stuff. Love it. Absolutely love it. And like I said, I know not every listener to this will be thinking, should we all be the CEO? I mean, some of you, what am I trying to say? Some of you will be thinking, I don't want to be the CEO of brand me. And I get it. I totally get it. But honestly, watch some of Gianmarco's clips. He knows what he's on about. Very, very, very funny guy. So really exciting to see that. I think he epitomizes the sort of the current thing. God, I can't even describe it without sounding so old. But this is what it means to be a contemporary, successful, doing it your own way comic these days. 10 years ago, we were like, God, what's it going to look like in 10 years? And it's this. It's what Gianmarco and also what Jeffrey Asmus is doing. The king of crowd work. I think he's got loads of clips online as the king of crowd work. And I'm pretty sure Jeffrey's special is called The Greatest White Comedian or something like that. It's just brilliant. So that's coming up soon. Familiarise yourself with Gianmarco and with Jeffrey ahead of his forthcoming appearance. That'll do for now. 20 minutes of extras, as I'm sure you know by now, on the Insiders feed. Join up at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. I hope you enjoy them. Now, you might think after an episode like that, I would do a post amble at you full of, you know, wild speculation about pipelines and click funnels and sort of the whole system, the ecosystem of building out one's brand. I'm not, but I will say that there is something that may interest you. I've been releasing little segments of on LinkedIn. This is not my attempt to get you all to suddenly convert to yet another fucking platform. But if you are the sort of person who regularly uses LinkedIn, chuck us a follow on there. It's Stuart Goldsmith brackets Comedy Insights. But I'm sure you can just find it by searching my name. There can't be that many of us. Then there may be something on there that I am now chucking out once a week on a Monday that is of interest to your interests. Right. No post amble today because by the time you hear this, I will be at the Glastonbury Festival and I'm packing for it now and constantly. And God, it takes longer every year. But I tell you what, I'll tweet it now. I will tweet a photo. No, I won't. I'll Instagram it at Stuart Goldsmith Comedy. It's photos. It's Instagram, right? That's the whole point. I will put a photo up there right now of the genuinely incredible van packing that I have been that I've pulled off this year. It's second to none. And look, I'm going to be 46 soon. There's no point pretending I don't enjoy packing a fucking van. What I did was I rigged two separate bungee cords, like aerially at either end. and then all of your separate bungee cords can lash down. Yeah, if this has got you frothing, check out the Instagram. It's at Stuart Goldsmith Comedy. All right, pals. Right, that'll do for now. Thank you, Nathan Wood, producing the show. The logger was Susie Lewis. The music was by Robs Mountain, who you can see at Glastonbury if you're there. He is there playing with Hot Chip, and he also has a band called Black Peaches. I'm not sure if they're playing. I think maybe Rob's doing a DJ set. I'm not sure. He told me and I immediately forgot. Which is rude of me, but I can't be digging out the information now. I've got to get out of here and get back to packing. Thank you for listening. More coming up soon. Cracker with Nish coming up soon. I hope I can also reveal, I hope we get clearance on the one that should have been out 2 weeks ago. And if you didn't hear Lee Kyle's from last week, jump on and grab that, because it's a blinder. All right, bye for now. I love you. Goodbye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.